Hi, hey, this is Authority Zero, and you're listening to the Mabel Syndrome Podcast.
Yeah!
It sucks, I still think Mabel, she's the bomb.
Hey everyone, it's Kristen with Mabel Syndrome, and I'm here with my favorite co-Mabel, Jessica.
Hello, everybody.
Hello. Today's episode is a great one. It's the first episode in March, and it's a great way, actually, since February was kind of all of our love episodes, this is kind of a continuation of the love episodes.
Mm-hmm. And I'm really excited about this one, because this interview was a huge one for me in terms of, like, nostalgic bucket list, someone I've been listening to for a really long time.
Oh my god, it's legendary. Like, so now we get to add to our list of insanely legendary punk rockers that we have had on the Mabel Syndrome podcast. We get to add Dr. Frank.
Yes, Dr. Frank Portman of Mr. T Experience. But there's also so much more about him that people don't know, or maybe they don't know. He's a published author, and yeah, Mr. T Experience is just such an incredible band. They've been around for so long. They've got so many releases. And the album Love Is Dead is, like, pretty much one of my diehard, like, soundtracks to my youth kind of albums.
What's your favorite song on that album?
Oh, all of them are really amazing. Deep, Deep Down is probably my favorite song because... Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's funny. It's got a funny story behind it. It comes across as like this intense sort of love song, which I always thought it was, but it's actually about a true story of a girl that got murdered, which I think is just funny. Not funny that she got murdered. It's just funny that
you and I always think murder is funny.
We do. Shout out to Small Town Murder, the boys of Small Town Murder podcast, who have been tweeting us, which makes me really excited. Anyway, Yeah, so I really, really love that song. And what else? What's my other favorite song? Okay, I'm going to pull it up right now because I'm having a bit of a brain fart. So
the first two songs are my favorite. Sockcloth and Ashes.
Yep.
And ba 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 ba.
I know, that's so good, isn't it?
It's so catchy. Like, I dare anyone to listen to that song and then not sing it all day long.
Exactly. Okay, I'm going to pull it up right now because the song that I love is, I just can't remember the name, but I listen to this. This is like one of my go-to albums that I listen to in the shower. So I bring my wireless speaker in and I like blast it and sing it really loud. It's just one of my favorite shower albums. Oh, here it is. It's track number, weird. It doesn't, 1, 2, 3, 4. Oh, weird. Oh, it's, sorry, I'm looking at the album version, so it's like A side, B side. So it's a song, I'd Do Anything For You, and it's, my favorite part about this song is that it's just, like, cute and sweet, and all of a sudden, this, like, fucking rock out section comes on at the end, and I literally, like, sing it really loud in the shower while I'm washing my hair, and then just, like, fucking headbang and give her. I do, all the time. That's all the awesome. Time. But the whole album's really good. I think it's one of their most famous albums. For me, it just came out at the right time. And it just kind of happened to be on heavy rotation when I was at a certain age. So,
yeah, for sure. The best song title is I'm Like Yeah, But She's All No.
So
it's just funny.
It's so funny because there's all these things like So when we went to on our road trip last summer and we got invited to this amazing acoustic show at John Jughead Pearson's house. Dr. Frank was there doing acoustic stuff, and it was literally like, you know, 30 of us sitting on the living room floor while they sang, and we all were sweating and drinking beer. It was great. And it was quite the experience. But he's a really funny guy because he writes all these songs about heartbreak and love and being this like goofy guy who doesn't get the girl, or you know, like those kinds of things.
It's all like unrequited love, right?
Yeah.
And Even Hitler Had a Girlfriend is one of my favorite songs too. It's like, even fucking Hitler had a girlfriend and I can't get a girlfriend. Like, what the fuck is wrong?
I love
this picture. And I love it because I can relate to that,
so
right?
Good.
Like, not Hitler necessarily, but you're like, you know, when you're a teenager and you're dating or you're whatever, and you're like, why did he choose her?
It's like, come on.
Yeah.
He's basically saying, like, I'm worse than Hitler. Like, nobody loves me.
Yeah.
And I love you more than toast. There's just so many.
You know what I love about him? And I've said this from day one, like, my favorite punk rock is funny punk rock. I love funny and tongue in cheek and sarcastic and witty. Like, witty punk rock is the best. And that's what his stuff is. It's like love songs that are witty and self-deprecating. And I love it so, so much.
Yeah, it's definitely what he does. So,
to interview him was just like a highlight for me.
Yeah, it was awesome. And then there was like a funny part in the middle where he lost his audio and we had to piece it together. And he was really, really great about, you know, just in the interview, trying to like make sure everything went okay. And do you want to mention the like one really funny part of what happened?
So there are two things when you're listening to this interview, there are two things to take note of. And the first one is that just like a few minutes in, maybe 10 minutes in, his cat like knocks his microphone over or something. And all of a sudden we lose audio and Jessica and I are like, what's going on? And it goes silent. And then he didn't know it, but his audio stopped recording at the same time. And so then we pick up later. So there's kind of this weird jump in the interview. And so that's what happened, is like there's a whole half an hour of our interview that got cut because his audio wasn't recording. So that's the first kind of funny thing that happened.
And
then
the second funny thing
is towards the end of the interview, and his doorbell rings and he goes, hold on, I have to, you know, let me go check and see who's at the door. And then we'll just leave it at this. And then I was going to cut this part out, but it's too funny. I literally was listening to it and laughing out loud because it's a little behind the scenes glimpse of what Jessica and I do, like when we're interviewing somebody, like we start whispering when he's answering the door, and just what we say to each other is really funny. So,
and most podcasts would cut that part out, but we're leaving it because it's definitely true Mabel syndrome, you know,
it's definitely
us. So if you're wondering what the fuck's going on while you're listening to the interview, that's just a little hint.
And turn it up because we're whispering. We're like, yeah. it's funny. I won't ruin it. I just think it's hilarious.
It's
so
pretty good.
That's my self-deprecating.
It's genuine.
We're leaving the bad part right in there just so you guys can all get a good laugh at us.
Yeah, definitely.
But for people that don't know Mr. T Experience, they were one of the bands that came out of the late 1980s Bay Area Gilman Street, you know, bands. So they were there when Green Day was there and Screeching Weasel and Operation Ivy and those legends, and Mr. T Experience was there. And one of the things we do talk with Frank about was the fact that, you know, a lot of those bands at that time were very political, and there was a lot of like political angst going on. It was the Reagan era and all this kind of stuff. And there's Mr. T Experience talking about love songs and writing love songs and performing them at Gilman Street. And I just think that's really cool. And for anyone, maybe people don't know what Gilman Street was too. It was like a DIY punk bar at the time. And there was no fee to get in, or it was like you pay a membership fee. They kind of went through these different phases where the people who visited the punk rock club or played at the punk rock club like were part of the decision making group. Mm-hmm. And they made their own rules about what was okay there and what was not okay, and they charged different rates, or, you know, it's just, look up Gilman Street 925, I think 924 Gilman Street, mm-hmm. something like that, and read about it. And I mean, it's fascinating, like this little punk rock club and what was going on there. And the bands that came out of there, like I said, Green Day, Operation Ivy, Screeching Weasel, Mr. T Experience. There's so many awesome ones. But anyway, so Mr. T Experience, I mean, it was basically formed by this man, Frank Portman, Dr. Frank, and some other guys. But Dr. Frank has been the longest and only, you know, original member that's still left. And he's the main songwriter and performer and singer and everything. And he's an amazing man. And he's also written three books, actually, that I've read, and I highly recommend them. They're fun. They're really fun reads.
It's young adult novels, yeah, is what it is. That's sort of the genre that he writes in. Mm-hmm. What else can we say about them? I feel like I'm just gonna like gush and swoon and be like, oh,
I know.
Well, it's funny because how I said earlier that I listened to his songs in the shower. When I met him in Chicago and we're in this house and I literally like, it was one of my most starstruck moments, I think, and I like had a beer and you're like, go talk to him, like, look, let's get a picture. And I like kind of like accosted him as he was walking through the kitchen from behind. I was like, hey, and he turned around and he was really sweet, but I was like, I like really like your music and I listen to you while I'm in the shower. And he was like, oh, thanks. And I was like, that was really awkward. He goes, yeah, but that's okay. He was really great.
Yeah,
but that's my Frank Portman moment.
That's so funny when you meet somebody that you do admire and like you don't know what to say to them sometimes, and the weirdest shit comes out of your mouth, you know, and it totally yeah, makes them feel weird. Like I remember one time I was sitting next to Roger Lima of Less Than Jake backstage, and I didn't know what to say to him either. It was like one of my first times meeting him, and I go, yeah, so when I was a guidance counselor, I would put up, you know, Less Than Jake lyrics around my, you know, my classroom and around my office and stuff. And so teenagers could like relate to the lyrics of your songs and stuff. And he goes, yeah, that's weird.
That's so funny.
And I go, yeah, that was totally weird, wasn't it?
Yeah, thanks for pointing it out. Thanks for making me feel more awkward.
That's, yeah, awesome. So but it is, it's just like the, like something just kind of pops out of your mouth when you totally first meet these people, and who knows what it's gonna be. But
I feel
people aren't familiar with Mr. T Experience, mm-hmm, I would say check out Love Is Dead and Our Bodies Ourselves. Those are my two favorite albums. So if you're not familiar with them, download those two albums and listen, and you're gonna fall in love with them.
Definitely. And this is a little bit of a long interview, right? So
yeah,
so We're gonna probably cut to it right now instead of continuing to rant, because I could ramble on with you all day.
I know.
I could.
What
I know.
Song do you want for the end?
I think we should play Deep, Deep Down, just because it's such a good song. I love it. It's,
yeah,
funny about murder, but people feel like it's a love song. It's just very stereotypically tongue-in-cheek awesome. So
yeah,
I think, great, we should end the day with the interview with Deep Deep Down by Mr. T Experience off of the album Love Is Dead. So we are here today with Frank Portman, a.k.a. Dr. Frank, founding member of the popular and amazing punk band Mr. T Experience. And for those of you that don't know, Frank is also an author, but we are going to dive into that a little bit later. So welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I just caught you with a mouthful of beer right as I said that.
Yeah, that was good timing.
It's sort of like when you're like a server or a waitress and it's like part of your job description to catch people with their mouth full.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think
so. That sounds like fun.
It's part of it, really. What are you drinking?
What about when they're in the middle of like a really intense conversation?
Oh, I hate those people. Don't have intense conversations while I'm trying to serve you. The other thing is too, is that people on their phone. That's the other thing. Do you know how many times you go up to a table to serve them and ask them how they are, what they're doing, and they all ignore you because they're on their phones?
Oh, that's annoying.
Yeah. It makes me want to accidentally spill
very
water
insulting
on their iPhone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah, people are terrible and they're best avoided. That's yet another anecdotal evidence for that basic premise, which I've never had reason to doubt. So,
exactly. So, what are you drinking, Frank?
This is a Radaburger Pilsner. It's, ooh, the cheapest German beer you can get at the place I go to get things like this. They recently, not recently, actually, it's, you know, for the last decade, the San Francisco Bay Area has had this kind of war on normal beer, where it's very hard to get like a regular, it's all, you know, oatmeal, organic, raspberry, stout, kind of, you know, stuff that maybe it's good. I don't know. I would never touch it with a 10-foot pole, but it's not beer. And it used to be that my favorite beer, that I engineered my taste so that my favorite beer would be Budweiser, on the theory that I'd always be able to get the favorite because that was the one standard. And then they banned it from the place I live. So you gotta go. I don't know why it's not. It's I'm sure it's supposed to be oppressive or something. I don't know what it is. We're too fancy for it. And I guess maybe they do bad things. So you got to go back to Germany. And fortunately, the German, the cheap German beer is pretty darn good. So that's why I am having this imported, it says, on a little ribbon. Ooh,
can you hold the label up so I can see it?
Yes. I don't know if this is, can you?
Yeah, I got it. I got the sense of it. Only because I like looking for cheap imported beer. So,
so did you beer, used to have Budweiser on your rider and stuff? Is that like what you asked for?
Yes, yes. And still, I mean, not that our rider is ever honored. Like it's, I can, I know it's been a long time since I arrived at a show, and you know that it's more like a, it's not even like a wish list. It's like a. An imaginary practice. You say, if we were the sort of band that would have shows in which a writer was honored, this might be the sort of thing. And you knew you could put anything on there. Beer is all right. Gatorade, batteries. Sometimes people, you know, you could put a Christmas tree.
Right.
You know.
If you're so inclined.
A mini horse. A small
I would put that on mine.
You can, yeah.
Okay, so like your dream rider. What's your dream rider? Like, what's your, if you could go to every show and get the three things on your dream rider, what would it be?
Yeah. Well, when I'm asked about it, to answer the question honestly, practically, yeah, some kind of light Pilsner beer, and you got to specify something other than Budweiser these days. Pacifico, they always have. That's all right. If you're on the East Coast, I really like Yingling. They laugh when you ask for that because I guess they think that's not that special, but it's kind of special here. They don't have it here. There's some kind of agreement that you can't transport it past the Mississippi, just like in the movie Eastbound and Down. Smokey and the Bandit. I'll tell you though, there was a bar. I hope I'm not going to get anyone in trouble. Getting in trouble already happened on this, but there was a bar in San Francisco that was a Pittsburgh themed bar that was set up by Pittsburghians, and they had a secret, I don't know where they got it, maybe they flew it in their luggage or something, but they had a bunch of Yingling, and if you asked for it, they would sneak it to you under the, you know, on the down low, and then they got caught. It's like some weird licensing thing where we don't
makes
have
it taste more delicious when you're sneaking it.
And it is delicious. You know, tastes like a bottle of bread. It's a you know, beer flavored beer. It is good. It is good stuff. And that was, you know, and I would always just put the various liquors. And in my world, that's not very diverse. Beer, wine, and whiskey, and usually the safest thing is Jameson, which is good stuff. And so.
You know
what's that now?
It's Jameson.
Oh, I can't see you. I'm only seeing. Are you holding up some Jameson? That's what you're drinking now is the Jameson.
Well, I technically have two drinks, but one of them is a glass of Jameson.
Right. So yeah. So and that, the great thing about that is that if you can keep the other bands from stealing it, and then you can take it along with you, and you can come back from a little tour with, like, you know, 14 bottles of Jameson, which does can set you up for a good few months at home, at least my rate of drinking the Jameson. Other people used to, you know, sometimes people would put socks on their riders, but Yeah, well, because, you know, it's one of the things that you got this laundry situation when you're, especially when you're a long tour that is low budget, and you got a little van, and laundry is hard to do, and sort of regarding your socks as disposable solves a lot of problems. And I suppose you could do it with underwear or panties if you're a lady, which would probably be very useful as well. But the problem is, and I think this might be, I don't want to put words in your mouth as ladies, but for me, with underwear and socks, I don't want some promoter picking them out for me, you know? So I want to be in charge of that myself. So that would make things more convenient. They put, you know, batteries for their little effects.
I was thinking like vibrator. That's what I thought.
You have a budget for each show, right? It's usually not that much. I don't know how much a vibrator costs, but it's probably
a lot.
Would use up your whole budget, if not more. So I would think very carefully about that strategy if you
might
were
not,
the,
yeah, might not be very
the...
wise.
I love hearing about what people put on their riders. I think it's a very fascinating thing. Like when we go to shows and we see what people have, it always fascinates me.
It is kind of interesting because of the process that it goes through, because you've got an agent, right? And you know, he needs some information from you about what to expect. And it's a, you know, a stage plot. And so that the club knows what you need and what you're doing. And then, you know, the hospitality writer. And I just picture everyone at the clubs that we play in just looking at that and just like laughing at it before they throw it in the garbage. So that's fun.
When we were at a festival this past summer, Kristen and I, and we were in the green room, and all the bands shared the same green room, and everybody's riders. And I can't remember which band it was, but there was like all these bands listed and all their drinks and all their things. And then one of the bands, the only thing that they had listed on their rider was Jack Daniels. And so it was just like all these bands had other things, and then just one band had just a big bottle of Jack Daniels.
Those are some cool guys. What band is that?
It might have been.
That was Bigwig.
Was it Bigwig?
Oh yeah. All right. I remember those guys.
It was Bigwig. Yeah.
Yeah. That's fun. I mean,
it's keeping it simple, you know.
Yeah. What really happens is you go there and you negotiate with the people, and if you're nice to them, then they'll be nice to you. You know, like the song goes. So. You know, you can't rely on these things, but it is when it happens, when you get there and there's this array of stuff, usually it's beyond what you would dare to ask for when they really actually do it. So then you're like, wait, am I in the wrong club? So that's nice.
I feel like I would like to fuck with people and be like, assorted jelly beans, red only, strawberry, not cherry. And I would like be just completely batshit crazy just to see what happened.
Right. I mean, I think nothing would happen really, but you know, a lot of times, you know, messing with people, if it only even just happens in your own head and they're not aware of it, is just as good.
It's just as good.
That's true.
That's awesome.
That's true. So we actually met you on our road trip this summer at Jughead's house.
Yeah. Yeah.
At the barbecue.
Right. That was a fun night.
It was awesome.
Yeah, that was really fun. Yeah, we went to the day show, the Sunday afternoon barbecue.
The next day.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was hot. It was hot and sweaty and muggy.
Hot?
Yeah.
It was, yeah.
It was real muggy. It was the finale to our big road trip. We did, Kristen and I, so I flew across the country to Boston. We drove from Boston to Chicago, did a couple shows, and then we drove from Chicago back to Boston. And we finished our sort of road trip with Jughead's Basement, which was awesome. How does that stuff come about for you guys? Are you guys just like buddies and you decide to, does he call you up and be like, hey, I'm doing this, you want to come over? Or how does that go about for you guys?
Yeah, basically, you know, I don't do that many things. I have, but I'm willing to consider anything, and if it can be made to work, I'll do it. And that's just the situation where he said, I'm doing this, do you want to? And I said, well, can I do it without losing any money? And if the answer is yes, I'll do it. If the answer is no, I really have to think hard about it, because, you know, if you do a whole lot of things for free, then you end up not being able to do anything in the end. And as another sort of side to that is that as people start noticing that you're doing things for free, then they stop offering to pay you. Right. Just, you know, for the sake of equality or something. So you got to choose.
Doug Ed was really cool about that too. Like he said right up front with the ticket price, like part of this goes for artist transportation and part of it is a fundraiser, you know, that's going to go to mental health charities and that sort of thing. So that was your cat that did that? But it was so different than what was going on in the 80s, right? I mean, mid-80s was like the angry political stuff. And even at Gilman Street, that's what everyone was doing, right? So for you, I just think it was really ballsy for you to come out with these albums that were love songs about girls and, or maybe not, but that's, you know, what they seem to be about. And it was really different. So maybe that's what you
were feeling. There's a confrontational spirit that was there from the beginning. Not so much with records, but you know, when we first started playing, you know, that's the thing that the world, the 1977 world that I was all into, that I tried to recreate 10 years later, wasn't there anymore. And what was there was, you know, this thing that you're describing. It was pre-Gilman, but it was just a very it was not the kind of a scene where you did songs about girls, where you did pop songs, where you did love songs. It made people very angry, and it was very hot. They were very hostile to us. And it was like a, you know, you get some energy from being hated, and that's definitely part of it. And then, you know,
was that just from men, or was it from women? Like, were there women in the crowds or in the scene that were getting pissed off too? Or were the women just being like, oh, that song's about me and I want to know
Right. And it didn't get, and I'll say that when we were first doing it, my songs weren't that good. So maybe it wasn't, it was more ambition than execution, maybe. And I gradually figured out how to do the kind of thing that you're talking about, that someone would say, oh, that's a song about me, or, you know, which I know happens, and I'm grateful that people do enter into it that way. And then it wasn't so much the case, but it's not like anyone could hear or tell what was going on anyway. And as far as the, you know, it was basically that scene. It was a lot of like hostile, aggressive, I want to say masculine energy maybe, but you know, a scene like that is, you know, primarily guys and their girlfriends are just as angry and hostile as well. You know, there isn't a, this was a very regulation rock and roll situation, even though they weren't playing rock and roll as I would define it. We set the parameters of our own world. And it was, you know, we would do these little shows that would be basically, we would be in during our time on the stage, there would be this bubble of this thing that we weren't doing very well, but we had an idea and we were trying to do it. And it was a throwback in a lot of ways, a throwback to a thing that nobody even knew about in any real way, which is an interesting thing to do. And then by the time the scene of the East Bay scene that was, you know, that Gilman and all that came about, I would say that we did that stuff we did set a bit of the course of the way that happened. And then we were an odd man out from that too. So then it was still like, even though it was more along the lines of the thing that, that we were shooting for, you know, we still were, was still a bit confrontational and, a bit like You know, I never felt that we welcomed in the welcoming bosom of the scene. It was always, everyone's always a bit skeptical, but so it was this thing where I consciously did think, because I always thought, you know, I'll stop doing this when it becomes impossible to do, but then, you know, this will be excavated sometime and then someone will realize what was happening. I'll make this excavation that will happen after I'm dead as good as I can make it. And then it.
So was that a conscious decision? Like, to, you know, like, okay, there's all the, there's all these other bands going on and we're going to be different. We're going to have, you know, we're like, what was.
No, it was not.
What was the time that you started writing songs and why did you choose to kind of focus on relationships and that kind of thing?
I mean, it was a genuine reflection of the kind of person I was, which I was not a tough guy. You know, I was not a juvenile delinquent.
I was trying to be
I was just laying it out there. The thing is,
were you getting your heart broken by girls?
Sure, of course. I mean, that's part of. Well, I was gonna say growing up. That's not even, you know, after you're all grown up, that still happens. I mean, that's like the human.
It happens. It happens forever.
Yep,
it will never stop happening.
The human condition. And as long as you realize, I think when you're a kid, sometimes you think, oh, there's gonna be a time, you know, in the future when all this stuff is going to sort itself out, but you know, not really. But then, you know, you play the hand you're dealt with, and we were dealt this hand of, you know, just not being approved of by the world that we were in. So, you know, there's the point where the decision comes in, because you could decide, I'm going to try to be like all these people who are approved of and see if I can do that. Instead, you say, well, you know, screw you guys, I'm doing it anyway. And that's, if there's anything punk rock about my stuff in terms of, I don't know what the definition of that is, but that would be the, maybe the one way, because it's like, have this thing with no constituency and you do it anyway and force it on people. That is if anything is quote punk, that is it.
Punk.
And so
that's what it is.
That's what we were doing. So.
So like of all of your songs, like, you know, you've got all these songs that people relate to about relationships and growing pains and, I mean, awkwardness and, you know, have you ever had any like exes or girls be like, that song's about me, what the fuck, or been angry, or has anybody ever come back to you with that and been like, what are you doing? What's up?
Yes. Now there's this is a thing that is well known, I think, Jimmy Webb, who's the guy who wrote, he's a songwriter. He wrote MacArthur Park and Galveston and, a lot of great songs. He wrote his songwriting memoir, and he has a whole section called The Girlfriend Problem, in which he says you cannot be a songwriter and have a wife or a girlfriend, because you will constantly be censoring yourself. You can't be honest. I would say that's not the case for me so much, because I had such a weird, volatile, screwy personal life that if there was anything wrong with it, that would be a minor part of it. there's also the other side of that, which is not the thing that Jimmy Webb was talking about, which is that you have important people in your life, including girls that you've dated and girlfriends, that really want there to have been a song about her or them, and are kind of offended that, or then, you know, there's,
well, that's true. Like if I dated you and then broke up and then there was no song about me, I'd be like, what the fuck? So
I didn't break your heart enough.
Or then there's the girl say, is that one about me? Did you write that about me? Is that about me? Is that about me? Is that about me?
Right.
I mean, that's a thing that I've experienced. I've never had a thing of, I know people who have had this, situation where the girlfriend just gets so angry about a song that she thinks is casting aspersions on her,
that just happened to a good friend of ours. Yeah,
he's not allowed to play it anymore, and it is this constant thing that, and so yeah, that would be a significant problem. But
I feel like if I was dating a punk rocker putting out love songs and albums, if I was 17 and he was putting those songs out, I'd be like raging. But I, as a grown up, I feel like this is fuck over it. I don't know. That's
most,
just me.
Most of my real, meaningful relationships have been with women who are with the program. Like, they know what I do and they like
what it entails.
And, you know, that's not a thing that is ever, it's not an opposition to any personal relationships that I've ever had.
Do people though come up to you and say like, I got to tell you like my heartbreak story, like here's what happened to me, or, you know, do guys try to
Well, I get asked for advice a lot, and that's that kind of,
really?
Oh yeah. Like, especially now with the internet, I get Facebook, you know, pop-up message pop-up every week or so. I mean, I would say that's the frequency of someone saying, listen, I have this terrible problem.
Is love advice?
Because I'm going through a divorce. I was just thinking, you know, seem to know a lot. Can you help me? And, I'm always try to be as nice and helpful as possible, but that is a really kind of not such a great situation to be put in, because
I am not a therapist,
yeah. And of all the people in the world, I'm probably the person you should most know not to go for advice. You know, it's like
because the love song that I connected with the most is actually about a murder. So really don't.
I mean, if what you know about me and my personal relationships is the character sketches that are and narratives in those songs, that's not a very good track record. I mean, there's a
it doesn't seem like you know what you're doing.
It's fictional. It's like it requires some understanding, I suppose. But yeah, no, and you know, just some lower mid-level punk rock guy. That's not who you should take advice from. It just as a general rule, but it happens. And
awesome.
People are
that's
sincere.
A general rule in life.
They're sincere about, you know, wanting, if you're desperate, if you're in a rock bottom emotionally, you'll reach out for anything. And in those situations, I feel like just a kind word is both the most and the least I can do. And it actually
maybe because people call you doctor. It's because you're a doctor. People are like, oh, he's a doctor. That's definitely what it is. He knows what he's talking about.
People do seem to know. It's true. Even though they know, even if they know it's just a stage name, people somehow do seem to take you more seriously when you adopt a title. It's really weird. And people
I
ask,
love it.
Yeah,
I love weird shit like that.
People ask me what kind of a doctor I am, and they're all impressed and everything. And I often quote this line from this old movie starring Victor Mature, where he is Dr. Otto, I think is his name. And he says, what are you a doctor of? And he says, a doctor of nothing, Miss Smith. It sounds impressive, harms no one, and doesn't cost anything, which is more than you can say for most doctors. And even after that, which is a good line, I kind of flubbed it a little bit, but it's a good line, and it does like whittle me down to size, but it doesn't matter. It's still, you know, you still get that doctor look from them.
And then people are still like, I have had a fever for 3 days, I have a rash that looked like this.
Well, I'll tell you,
just tell me what's going on.
I'll tell you one thing that I discovered by accident, the power of just calling yourself a doctor was there were several times, but the one particular time my old friend Joe King was in rehab, and I was trying to get a message to him, and there's a a thing. There's a convention in those kinds of institutions where they're not supposed to tell you if the person's there. So if you call them and you say, I want to speak to Joe. Can I speak to him? We can't. I'm not sure if he's there, sir, but if you leave your name, I'll leave a message. And if he is here, he will call you back. I say, okay, just tell him Dr. Frank called. And then the response was, oh, I'm sorry, doctor, I'll go get him. So it's like, all you have to do is say you're a doctor and you pretty much actually are one. So there's,
you know what?
You said your name. You didn't lie.
No, I didn't do it on, I didn't do it on purpose. It was just, I accidentally stumbled into this truth about social dynamics.
Other than the fact that I work in the medical field for real, I feel like I'm going to start using that. Like,
yeah.
I mean,
oh, you work in the medical field. For,
I could be Dr. Jess.
Yeah. I mean, you have to, you know,
but I'm not a doctor. I'm not a doctor, but.
Right. But I start calling you Dr. Jess, then you will be.
Right. Exactly.
Oh, good. Our biggest fans will start reproducing into the weirder.
And then they'll start Facebook messaging you about for love advice, and then, you know.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well,
I think you're trying too hard, man. I think you should just take a little break from it. And, you know, I mean, I don't know what
take some deep breaths, meditate, count to 10. Tell him what you love about him, even if it's hard.
This is the sort of thing. And it's hard not to play the role that is presented to you to step into.
Oh, I'd play the role.
Because you don't want to disappoint people. I mean, it's funny because I am a very misanthropic person, but I also really believe strongly in being nice to people, because I just think it doesn't cost you anything, and it's just you have a better environment when you are kind and polite to people. I'm sorry, can we pause? Because there was someone at my door, and I want to make sure it's not something bad.
Just keep it going, and I'll cut it out.
Right. Yeah, just don't stop. Yeah.
Be back in a sec.
What? Do we wrap it up? I don't know. I feel like, should we keep going and then edit, or what? Like, well, I'm just thinking about his time. Like, is he having a good time? I don't know. He's laughing. And he's drinking. And I feel like...
I was just about to ask him about his wife.
Oh, okay. We can do that. Well, when he comes back, we can start fresh however we want.
Okay.
Like, where do you want to go from here? This is still recording.
Oh my God.
This is going to be in our outtakes.
Okay, it was a false alarm, so we're all right. Okay. So
was there nobody at your door?
No, it was a guy that was, I don't know if he really was from the phone company, but he was trying to get in the building.
That's creepy as fuck. No. I live in Canada.
I live in Oakland. This happens all the time. I just pretend I can't speak English.
Jessica's our little country girl.
I'm
she
like the middle of
things.
Nowhere country Canada girl. Canadian, not Canada girl. And it's like, if someone was to knock on my door and say they were from the phone company, I would panic. I would lose my shit.
Yeah.
I would not be able to deal with it.
And if it's so anywhere funny. Near sundown, you just don't do it. It's like, you don't want to make
like
eye contact.
Like when Chris and I drove across the country this summer, we were like, we stayed in a couple motels or hotels that were like, yeah. And every time we'd walk into a hotel, she'd go, what bed do you want? And I would go, in my head, I'd go, the one furthest from the door, because that means I die last. Like, she'll get killed first. And she'd be like, okay,
I
whatever.
I didn't know that. I didn't know you said.
That's and in my brain, I'd be going like, it's okay. If they kill her first, I have time to run.
That's a good strategy. Eat me last.
Yeah. Or eat her first and I'll run while you're on course number one. Like, that's how I think. Like,
thanks, Jess. That was really considerate.
My best
you.
Friend was telling me the other day, we went to college together and we stayed in, and I moved from a town of 4,000 to, like, you know, a large city. And she was like, yeah, don't you remember how at the end of our school year, of our first year of university, we had no forks or knives left in our drawer because every time you went to the bus, you'd carry a fork or a knife with you to attack somebody.
Oh, my gosh. You're not going to get very far with a fork or a knife, girl.
I could scratch the fuck out of somebody with a fork. I'm telling you.
I guess.
Or a butter knife.
All right. So where to? So to pick up where we kind of left off, I was going to say, I wonder if, you know, you do. It's always tricky to talk about personal stuff, right? So I don't know how open you are with this, but you do post pictures of your wife on Instagram and stuff. And so I wonder if people see you as like a success case, right? They're like, well, you seem happy and you're in a relationship. And I wonder, so maybe that's why people reach out a little bit.
Yeah, maybe. So sometimes the situation will happen, not so much with the people that make these internet message contacts, but you know, people look at your work and they don't understand that there is a difference between say the narrators of your songs and yourself. They just kind of think that this is a diary entry that you have like literally taken from your actual life and crammed it into a song. You know, sometimes that results in people, you know, getting kind of angry. How could you have done that to this person? This is a terrible attitude. But you know, then sometimes people are actually just that I'm in my head, I'm all messed up. But and in comparison to most of the people that I know and in my life in general, I'm pretty conventional, pedestrian, ordinary person. And there's nothing that crazy and failure-y about me. And so people are, people do find that hard to compute. They've hard to grasp. And so I've talked to some people that have it kind of resented a little bit. Well, I'm all this time and then you've got this hot girlfriend. What's going on here? You know, I've been,
right. It's like a personal,
I've been lied to all these years. I think that's a lesson that it's important for people to learn that for some reason it's not being communicated that this is a situation with an artist that, you know, that people can't, it seems like it's increasingly the case. They can't tell fiction from reality, and it leads to all sorts of problems. And in my own small corner of the world, in my own small way, I see that all the time where, you know, I mean, it could be that a given song that I wrote is literally about some actual situation, but it's not really, because to make something into a song, you have to make it rhyme and scan and all that. So right there, you're distanced from reality. But the idea, when I explain it to people and they get it, sometimes it's like completely shocking to them. The concept of, well, these are, you know, this song is a conceit. I had this idea. I wanted to get across the essence of this experience within 2 minutes and try to sum it up. And these are fictional characters. It's just like if you read a book or watch a movie. It's not like you're looking at the thing that actually happened. You're looking at a kind of a thing that steps off from it. And it's amazing to me how confusing that is to people.
How it happens.
I don't know what that is. I mean, I'm not sure what that comes
You know
from.
What?
But that's what music is. Music is personal, right? I mean, a movie is a third, you know, a third hand observer sort of thing. You're watching something else that isn't related to anybody that's actually in the movie. But music is, it's one person sometimes, or a band, and it's they wrote it, they're performing it. It's the most personal, one of the most personal art forms, right?
As well as the fact that as a 17-year-old girl, I would be laying face down on my bed crying, listening to that song, going like, that's exactly what's happening in my life. Music connects in a different way, right?
No, like, God, absolutely. You know, it's absolutely true. And that's one of the things that you can exploit when you're trying to, you know, because it is, because you're not only the writer, you're the singer and you're the performer as well.
Yeah.
But then, you know, you're a character. This is something, this is something that, you know, when I started writing books, I noticed the same thing from the book people, which is you'd think that people who are big fans of literature would have grasped that, what fiction is, but it's just not the case. And so, you know, like I, you know, they would, people would call me to account to try to, you know, justify the internal monologue of a fictional 14-year-old. So, you know,
how, yeah.
And it's like, well, you know, this thing you're talking about, that's the result of this narrative. So, you know, I just, you just said the same thing that I did in the book, just in a different way. But it's very yeah. hard to get that across. And I think, you know, it's also because mm-hmm. the people are, they, my analysis of it is that they don't, people aren't used to paying that much attention to things. And they've got these, often they have these sort of ready-made responses to everything that doesn't necessarily spring from the thing that they're angry about. And that when that's the situation, there is nothing you can do to disabuse them, because they're doing the thing they know how to do and it's easy to do. It's a bit, it's frustrating, but it's also kind of fascinating if you, as a person who, you know, in effect studies human dynamics, the fact
yeah.
that is easier than an honest engaging with the song or the text. Like, and I'm just talking about the people who get angry. I mean, the people who,
yeah.
You know, I mean, it's not most people. Most people who pay that much attention and get it have the response that you're talking about, which is that they sort of dive into it and embody it and feel it and everything. And I mean, that's obviously better. I wish more people would do that.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah.
Would you ever write a biography of a Mr. T experience? Have you ever thought about doing that?
I don't.
Yes, please.
Yeah, I don't think a biography, strictly speaking, would be interesting enough. It's not that eventful of a story. It's actually quite banal. But I mean, my answer to that question up until pretty recently would have been just a flat no for that reason. But lately, I've been writing a bit on the internet. Just I started it out because I was presented with a video from 1996 or something that I had never seen before, and it was, I chopped it up into songs and I posted it on the internet and then commented on the songs particularly, and I found a lot to say when it came to that. So I could imagine mm-hmm. doing that sort of thing, like kind of loosely, not a memoir about here's what happened with the band, but you know, tracing the songs and, you know, little anecdotes about that might not, if it were organized well, might not yeah. make a bad book. But yeah, just the story, that
it would be
the
awesome.
Behind the music of Mr. T experience would be really boring. There would be.
It's very cool what you've done on there. Like, you know, that's one of the yeah. things as a fan, and having access to blogs and Instagram mm-hmm. and Facebook and, you know, the internet as a whole. Like, this is a time where we have so much more access to connect with musicians that we like, and you know, what you've done with the videos and the old photographs and that sort of thing, that's a pretty big deal for fans. Like,
well,
it's a very cool thing.
It's cool, and there isn't a sort of an institutional structure to encourage it or support it. And maybe that's an app for someone to do. Like, you know, here's the
yeah.
musician, here's the thing that makes it easy. You just have to do it. And it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of effort. But I am at the point now where, and I never used to think of it that way, but, you know, I'm kind of enjoying curating the, quote, legacy, because, you know, I mean, it's not the greatest legacy in the world, but it's the only one I got. So, and if I'm not going to do it, no one else is going to do it.
It is pretty huge.
So
you're so self-deprecating.
You are. You fit in well with us. You're like the third Mabel, because I know. That's how
we get it. We get it. But it's hard to see someone that you admire so much saying that.
We joke around too, and we're like, oh.
I mean, that's nice of you to have that response. But what I'm saying is that since I started thinking of it this way, I'm sort of. It's given me a different perspective on it, and it's giving me a more positive perspective on it, honestly, because I can see yeah. the response it gets and how it's like inherently interesting and how not that many people do it systematically. And, you know, so that's why I'm hoping to reissue some old records and to do it in a interesting, like, documentary fashion rather than just slamming them out there like some people do. And so it's like, you know, it's not a thing that's going to make anybody very much money or any money, but there is something of value in it, I believe. And I wouldn't have always thought that, but it's basically was all sparked by this girl, Amy, handing me this DVD from this show in Seattle, where just looked at it and I thought, okay, I expected it to be terrible, but these songs are pretty, it's pretty clear. It's pretty, accurate snapshot of what seeing my band live would have been at that time. And I found out I had a lot of things to say about
these
individual songs. And so, yeah, so it's pretty good. It's a good personal project while I procrastinate on other more important things.
Are you writing other music right now, or are you writing a book?
I'm working on a couple of books. Lord knows when they will be finished, but I am working on them. A lot of my efforts, I've been doing that thing I've just been saying that takes up some time, and I've also been working on kind of the beginning stages of trying to do some interesting reissues and reaggregations of the old stuff to make it kind of make sense and put it in the right in as good of a context as we can to sort of say, you know, this is this thing that happened and it's kind of ongoing too, and it just sort of to try to put it in the right perspective. And that's kind of fun too, but it involves a lot of searching around for tapes and all that sort of thing, and it's a big, huge project. For songwriting, I have a lot of new songs. The way that it works for me is I will go for a long period and I just don't get anything, and then all of a sudden I'll just suddenly pick up the guitar and then something happens, and then when that happens it usually results in 3 or 4 songs, and then I kind of tinker away at those for sometimes years. But I've got a pretty, it's been a long time. So, I've put out the last 15 years, I put out 2 albums. So there's a lot of other stuff in there over that time that I do want to, I want to put out in some way before I die. So I got to get moving on it if that's going to happen. So yeah, I do.
I gotta get moving on it.
One thing I have learned is it's sort of a maturity, maybe is the explanation for it, is that I don't force things anymore. It's not like I must have a song and then force it to happen. I just when it happens, I'll catch it, and otherwise I don't really. And that's something I never used to do. And that, all of the marginal stuff that I've done have all been the result of trying to force it when I wasn't ready. That's something I've learned. But saying that, it's not the sort of thing where, when it's the initial thing where you get the idea for the song and you make it come back. And then you have to that's the thing you're waiting to catch. But once you've caught it, it doesn't make any sense, so you got to spend a lot of time tinkering with it and everything, and sometimes that never gets done. But it's not a bad way to spend your life, writing songs and putting them out.
Connecting with people and people, you guys have such a huge catalog that you're doing something right. You're doing something meaningful. You're doing something right. People connect, right?
That's the good part. That's the good part. A lot of times, I know that when we would, especially in the old days, and the old days meaning the first 10 years of the band's existence and beyond, and even continuing now, we would do shows in these empty rooms, and some women would invariably come and say, "Well, why?" why do you keep doing this? Why don't you just hang it up? And I always kind of feel that's on everybody's lips in a way, but there comes a point where you just have, where what you've done for better or worse is just a part of history, and it's like there's nothing mm-hmm. you can do about that either way. And so the interesting thing to do about it is, you know, see what you can do with it rather than, I mean, I think a lot of people just, you know, throw their hands up with frustration and try to avoid the subject, or they will, you know, keep trying to, you know, continue to try to be the next big thing in a world where there are no next big things, which is, mm-hmm. you know, which is a kind of a sad situation. But I have a measured approach to the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. I feel like we've been talking for 2 hours almost, but that I have like a million more questions. I feel like we need a part two.
Okay. Well, I'd be into that.
I feel like we need to subject you to a part two.
No, I mean, that would be fine with me, but do you have listeners who really would listen to 4 hours of me as the thing? Or does that matter?
We don't give a fuck because
we don't care.
So I have some bad
because
news.
Because here's the thing, like,
oh, okay. Tell me, and then I'll tell you my bad news.
I was just gonna say, like, you know, we sort of do this thing. We've been doing it for over a year now. We thought that nobody would listen. Nobody would agree to let us interview them. We approached Mabel Syndrome as like, we are fans of music, and we felt like there was this missing link where women weren't having any kind of voice. Other, you know, there's bands out there, but there was no podcasts or different things. So, you know, we sort of looked at it as like, nobody's going to listen to us. Who, you know, who the fuck wants to hear about us? We're just going to do it for ourselves because we love the music. We love people. We love learning, and we love each other. We're big sappy puddles. But also, so when you say like, who wants to listen to 4 hours of me? I'm like, I don't care. Cause I do. and also if there's 4 listeners or 400 listeners that want to hear it, then that's awesome.
I agree with that sentiment. And so I am at your disposal, ladies.
Awesome.
If you want to set up another conversation of this kind, you know, we could do it next week if you want. You could just let me know what a good time would be.
Oh, well, you've been awesome to talk with us this long. Thank you so much.
It's been fun.
So this is goodbye, more or less. And things have changed a lot, I guess. In such a mess and so out of hand. Though I think it went pretty much as you planned. It was so hazy till my eyes are clear. Now I can see better, but it still looks weird. Is that still you lying there? Why can't I find you anywhere? I still don't understand this episode or why you let us down that road. But I think you knew where it would lead and how something would come over me. I still don't know just what it was. I guess nobody ever really does know why they do the things they do. But did I have to follow you deep, deep down where it isn't safe to to say.